It's not generally known that there's a new series based on my life, which will soon be screened on the ABC, where I am played by, who am I played by? Someone excitingly glamorous. I can't think of who's going to play me, but it's going to happen. I mention this because sitting opposite me is the rakish Charles Waterstreet, and we're going to discuss Charles's life and times and the his interactions with Cleaver Green. First of all, Charles, lovely to see you. Isn't it weird we've never met?
Unbelievable, because we seem to follow the same people, have the same interests, and I read you religiously. So
I read you irreligiously.
But no, it is amazing. It's like you run into people you think you never meet, and then you don't run into people you think you would meet.
Well, we're making up for it now, mate. Now, look, we've just been discussing Pistorius. Would you or Cleaver represent him?
I'd give both my arms to represent him. He's given his legs. I would give my arms. It's a case of the century. You don't get many like that, and both the prosecutor and the defender are having the times of their lives, because it's a person who protests innocence, has a fair defence, and you've got glamorous, you know, supporting cast. I mean, you don't get a more beautiful person than a victim, and, you know, more tragedy than a man with a defect.
I think we've witnessed a genuine tragedy today in the downfall of O'Farrell. Let's switch to a local scene. You know, whatever his shortcomings, I don't think he deserved to have his head on a plate or on a pike.
I've forgotten every bottle of drink I've ever gotten from anybody. I mean, the whole thing is just ridiculous. There's been two very innocent victims of ICAC. One was Greiner, who set it up. And he was, you know, one of the most honest people you'd ever come across. And now Barry O'Farrell, for I don't believe too much in his beliefs, but as a party, but certainly he's straight arrow, and the whole thing is overkill of the First Order.
I've got a strange feeling he may survive, that we haven't seen the last of O'Farrell.
But New South Wales have a history of rum rebellions, but I think not over port.
Okay, now, so, as I said, this is Charles Waterstreet. How do you like to be addressed? Charles, Charlie?
Look, I've been Charlie all my life, except to myself. I keep calling myself Charles, but okay. Everyone who knows me calls me Charlie.
I'll call you Charles, because I don't really know you yet, but I want to do this. What's it feel like to have yourself writ large on the small screen?
Oh, well, it was fascinating at first to actually see parts of your life on screen, and watching it with the director and the actor and so on and so forth. But this year has been especially interesting because I was in New York, where Greg Kinnear played the lead in Rake, and really good. And New York was plastered with Rake posters all over the place. And I get off the plane coming back here, and all the buses are plastered with Richard.
I have to say that your character is the most lovable on television. Do you find that flattering?
I find that very flattering, especially as Richard goes
out
of his way to
help. Lovable yourself, are you?
No, I'm more roguish, but the more you know me, the less you want to. But Richard is an amazing actor, and although I may have provided the vase, he certainly arranged the flowers.
I understand that the American version thereof has not been as wildly successful as our indigenous one.
4 million viewers is high in my opinion, but it falls between two planks. Because he's an extreme character, you want him to do extreme things, but he's on Fox, which is like free to wear, and you're competing against things like Breaking Bad and Game of Thrones on cable, where where nudity is compulsory. So if you're on a free-to-air station, you can't have too many extreme conduct that are not family-friendly. But Greg Kinnear's done a fantastic job, and the show's very good, but it just straddles two worlds. I went to HBO with it, with Charlie Sheen, to do it, when Charlie was really down and out. And I thought that might
How
have been...
How charitable of you.
Well, there was some motive. I wanted to give him a lift up, and I thought he wouldn't even have to act. And he'd have his lines under his nose.
Yeah. Now, you gave up the grog years ago, didn't you?
I did, yeah, 15 years ago.
Why?
I had to.
Under what circumstances? I was talking about Kerry Packer giving it up after the fatal car accident. Why did you give up?
Well, I had to. I didn't realise there was an allotment that you got that many drugs, that much alcohol, and I'd used all mine, and I suddenly came to the realisation I had no more brownie points left. But I was down and out. I was obsessive and compulsive, and did my motto was excess and no further. And like many of us, I had to hit rock bottom. I ended up in a hospital for a week. After litigation with a well-known actress, and that did me in a bit. And I had a son by then, and I didn't want him to see me drunk. But I was one of the. I started 10 years before trying to give up. I was at dinner with Barry Humphries, and I was drinking Sambucas before dinner. So I'd have five flaming Sambucas before dinner. And he took me aside and said, "Do you know you've got a problem?" And I didn't realize. Well,
Barry's a great drink counter. I've been at dinners with people whose names I won't mention, and it never occurred to me they might have an issue. But Barry counts the drinks.
You know he does.
And later he says, so-and-so should be joining me at AA.
No, I don't think it's breaching any faith to say he took me to a meeting. And I certainly, after that, it took me 10 more years to actually give up the grog.
Do you miss it?
Not at all. No, not the grog, no. But I took it up originally because I grew up in a pub and it was part of the, you know, great Australian tradition to drink.
Excessive. You were brought up in a pub?
My family owned pubs for 100 years. Water Street's Hotel in Albury was next to the railway station. And so those days they had two different gauges for New South Wales and Victoria, and overnight passengers had to get off and stay at our pub. And so we made a lot of money until that backward step of, you know,
of unifying the railway lines.
Well, yeah, well, exactly.
Ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
Terrible, stupid idea.
Yeah, Australia was so much better off.
A Victorian knew who he was. He was 5 foot 1¼ inches, whereas in New South Wales was 4'8". And they're two different types of people.
Where does the humour come from in you, Charles?
I think it's a defence mechanism against that. You know, something. My mother was a bit of an alcoholic and there was a little at home, but mostly because I grew up in the bar and my father was a publican and he was the king of the counter. He was singing at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, with darkened lights because it was illegal. And I think a bit of Irish and a bit of son of a publican, son of a gun, and a lot of hiding under humour.
I think humour is evolution's way of coping with mortality, isn't it?
Oh, you can only laugh at it, you know. Yeah. I mean, otherwise it's just too grim.
Have you, over your longish life, been as concerned about mortality as I have?
Well, I've never had a fear of death. In fact, I spent the first half of my life trying to kill myself, but the second half trying to live forever. And you know, I've been to the gym every day since I gave up grog in a vain attempt to, you know, live forever. But mortality is something that always bewitches me because it's so fascinating to understand whether we exist or do not exist at any given point of time. But I must admit on public radio that I've taken an elevating drug recently that does lead me not to fear death. There's a drug called DMT, and it's...
Did you bring some for your interviewer?
I could make it available.
Thanks. We won't... Well, can we edit this bit out? That's very kind of you, Charles.
Yes, no.
I knew I'd like it.
Yeah. No, yes. Did you enjoy that?
Oh, dear. So Aubrey Wodonga, the Twains.
Oh, no, it was a city, you know, it was ruled by a man called Cleaver Bunton, and that's where Richard and I came up with the name of the character, Cleaver Green. Cleaver Bunton was Albury's mayor for 30 big years, and Albury was the centre of the earth, as you would know.
Absolutely.
When Richard and I were children, Cleaver Bunton was like a colossus bestriding Wodonga and Albury, and he became a senator when Lionel Murphy went to the High Court as a political neuter. And I think he was one of the world's most political neutral people in the world.
Richard Roxburgh is also an Aubrey Wodonga.
That's right. And if you look at his hair, his family owned the local Olympic pool. And that hair is not natural. It's a product of chlorine bleaching from doing lamps.
Don't be
bitchy.
I'm sorry. The truth had to come out.
I know you got a bit pissed that you didn't think you were getting enough remuneration from the...
I think that in showbiz, as you well know, the rooms can never contain the egos. But all that's behind us. It was all just silly.
Charlie, one of the things... I've said Charlie. One of the things that you and Richard plug into is that great Australian tradition of the larrikin. Now, even the word has evaporated from the lexicon now, hasn't it?
My first book was a larrikin's memoir. It was called... They tried to call it a larrikin's memoir, which is a great Australian word because it is a great Australian tradition. But I called it Precious Bodily Fluids in the end because... that was a quote from Dr. Strangelove about fluidation.
We all recognise the origin of that quote.
Well, it was predictable in the book because the backdrop of my book was that Albury had a referendum on whether to put fluoride in the water or not and voted 9-1 against it because it was obviously communism. And Cleaver Bunton was mayor, but he was neutral on it. But we all know that it rots. It rots... everything that it touches.
What's your attitude to the law? Do you see it as a science, an art form, theatre, justice?
I've been trying to get out of law since I started. I'm not going to do it when I grow up, that's for sure. But I'm like a pelican in an oil spill. You know, I'm doing flapping my wings to try and get out. I'm like Al Pacino.
They keep dragging you back.
Like Al Pacino and The Godfather, they drag me back in. But I've been luxury. I had a bit of a luxury because when I graduated in law, I hated law and wouldn't want to do it. So I taught law. I lectured in New South Wales Uni. And then a family you might not remember, but you might, Philip, called the Bartons, came back from South America. They were the Scaces of their time, but came back to face the music with $100 million that was allegedly stolen. And they tempted me out of academia. And I went into the bar, which was...
Everyone tells me you're very good at it.
No, that's a rumour I'm spreading. And
it's not true.
Not true.
So you wouldn't save Pistorius, you'd probably sink him.
Well, I'd be I'd skate through a bit like him. I certainly wouldn't have him crying as much as he is, but he's got a tale to tell. I mean, he's obviously got a short fuse, as short men do, if you noticed. But if you had no legs, you have a short man's fuse. But he's a fascinating, great case to do.
It isn't important, it isn't necessary, perhaps it isn't even desirable for you to like a client.
No, not at all. But you've got to know a client and you can't read a client by reading the paperwork. You've got to sit with them by osmosis and get their feel. And that's one of the things you have to go do is to go to jail, which is the most miserable and saddest place on earth, and spend quality time between bars and go through 14 gates. To see them, because it's 99% instinct law, you know, criminal law, it's 99% knowing the client and knowing what makes him tick.
Suddenly, I'm transported back to a very early meeting of the Australia Council. So this is, you know, 1971, two, something like that. And I'm taken aside by a lovely guy, a barrister, who thinks I'm not handling myself well in meetings. And he says, look, you've got to learn a few tricks. He said, I want you to say after me, with great respect. Yeah. And he said, if you think the person opposite is an absolute deal, you can embellish it a little with very great respect. And he said, then you say what you want to say. And he mentored me for some months and I liked him a lot. And I asked him why he'd never become a judge, and he said, I could not, under any circumstances, send anyone to jail for any reason.
I'm afraid I'm exactly the same, so I couldn't administer justice to anyone because I prosecuted one case in my entire life, Harry Miller. I cried when he went to jail.
Well, Harry was an old mate of mine as well, but... Yes.
Yeah, and so I cried when he went to jail. I thought, this is not in me. I'm a defender.
Yeah, but he used to ring me up from jail and negotiate Graham Kennedy's contract for a movie.
He is the very definition of a lovable rogue. I knew Patrick White pretty well then, who hated Harry because Harry had brought up the rights of
Voss.
And yeah. So Patrick, knowing that I was prosecuting Harry, was, you know, befriended me and took me to dinners and loved me immensely because I was getting Harry his gumption. And inevitably, I fell out with Patrick, as everyone did. And but I came to admire Harry very much.
Patrick was an incredibly snooty moralist on many issues,
but
wasn't he?
I'm very soft on him because I was down and out. They'd asked me whether I wanted my scholarship 1 year in one lump sum of 2,000 or fortnightly. I took it 2,000, lost it at the casino, and had nowhere to stay. And two girls who were minding Patrick's house for 6 months while he was overseas took me in, and I was introduced to the world of arts and letters, and I slept in his bed and I slept in his pyjamas.
Is that, I know how some people get radicalised, is that how you became artified?
Exactly, that's how I was introduced to the arts. I'd never read a book, and I'd never seen art properly. Growing up in the pub, all I'd seen was that Indonesian woman, the green Indonesian woman. And
Trenchikov paintings.
Yeah, that's it.
Barry Humphries is a great authority on Trenchikov.
Well, exactly.
Paintings.
And then suddenly I became part of Eastern Suburbs society and met artists and writers, and I loved them. And especially I'm Jewish writers and Jewish artists and the Jewish people of Eastern Suburbs. And I felt that I had been abandoned at birth and left in Albury, and I was obviously Jewish, and I found my chosen people, and it was a great change in me. It certainly changed my life.
One thing about you which never seems to have changed is you have, and I'm not going to say an insatiable lust, an absolute love of women.
Yeah, I think it's addictions, one of the addictions that I could keep up without it killing me. Although I'm getting
damn near killed you when with Kate Fitzpatrick, didn't
you? Yeah, that was a long piece where someone like myself who fancies themselves as a cross-examiner ends up 6 weeks in, you know, the box in being cross-examined about a love affair that finished 20 years earlier.
But that's one of the things I like about Rake. He may be very naughty, but it's all goodwill. He falls in love so often. He projects qualities onto women that they often don't really have.
Well, yeah, no, that's exactly right. We're both great romantics, and we love women, and we do everything to excess. Cleaver loved the owner or the worker at the brothel, and I think it's classless. Cleaver and I share a classless lust of women, no matter where they come from, no matter what their background.
Have you had your heart broken very often?
Even last year, I made as a baby boomer like you, Philip.
No, I'm older.
I tried to flatter you.
Baby booming. Yeah.
Well, anyway, I made the mistake of falling in love with a Gen Y, and I think I proved that baby boomer does not go into Gen Y like, you know, in mathematics. But, yeah, no, I'm still... it's fascinating. It's wonderful.
I want to go back to you and the law. We've both agreed it's awfully hard to send people to prison. My barrister, who died very young shortly thereafter, made the point he could never distinguish the criminal from the cop, which has become painfully apparent.
Oh, very, very much. And they all came out in the same boat, if you remember, in the First Fleet and thereafter. Very hard to distinguish the warders from the criminals.
Nonetheless, there is within your character and within Rake, within Cleaver, a great desire to see rough justice done, to see in a way decency triumph.
You know what, well, I think we both share the opinion that there are more than 50 shades of grey, and behind every behind every crime is a person, and there's a reason, and there's a sympathetic reason, and we try to tease it out. And
I was confessing the other day to my long friendship with Billy Longley, the Texan. One of the most charming, lovable people I've ever known, and yet think of all the people he put in the river.
I know, and I've met fabulous people in my life, and the most loyal, and the most loving, and the most tenacious, and fabulous people. And I share, I think, with my father, because he was a publican of a working class hotel, is that the people come in all shapes and sizes, but they've all you know, it's got one thing in common, humanity.
I remember when I first met Longley in H Division, he came out, I'd never heard it before, I realised later it was a cliche, but he said, never judge a bloke unless you've walked a mile in his shoes. That's one thing that you do, you don't judge them.
I think, yeah, but it's not something I deliberately do. I just think it's part of my nature that I was either lucky enough to grow up in a classless sort of working class pub where I would invite boys home to have a lemonade at the end of school and they'd say, oh, we're not going there. Mum says, my mother says the sawdust is 6 inches thick with blood. And it was a bit of a blood house. So we, I think I saw people as all equal. And the irony is the person in the next, we had the hotel next to the railway, and the person who lived in a tent next door was Dennis Richardson, who became the ambassador to America, and he lived in a tent and came from there to head of ASIO, to head of ASIS now. And
given your immense tolerance for human variety, can you hate? We've established that you can love.
No, I don't think I can, frankly, and it's something that I can see drives a lot of people, but I've never been capable of hate. In fact, you know, I have great reason, and people sometimes do take against me. I don't hate anyone. I can't.
You'd hate bad ideas. You'd hate bigotry, for example.
Oh, absolutely. I hate the idea. I don't hate the person that says it, and I don't hate the person that. I hate the crime, but the person who did the crime is. Usually got an excuse, usually got something to say. It's a funny thing. I'm fascinated. I'm a people perv. I just sit and watch. I love watching people in situations. I love sitting around and watching the jury. You know, it's just an endless fascination. And thinking, we get a choice of how to pick jurors. And what would you know? We get three choices. How would you know what a person's good or bad? Your gut instinct, and the same in, you know, I sit and watch in coffee shops, as many of us do in our dottery, and I'm endlessly fascinated. I could sit there for weeks and days.
I like your view about classlessness. Now, both of us know a lot of very famous and powerful people, and they're just as vulnerable,
yeah,
and just as human, and just as lost in many ways as anyone else.
That was a great insight when I was living at Patrick's. They were, you know, they were just the same as us. I met a large amount of celebrities, and they were just, you know, ordinary people with the same ordinary problems, and probably a little bit more ordinary in some cases.
Yeah, yeah.
Because some people become famous through hunger and ambitions and sheer drive who don't necessarily reflect that in their personality, but... I wish I had a bit more ambition and drive.
Tell me about one of your real cases as opposed to a rape case. Tell me one that you recall and place special value on.
Well, I know this, unrehearsed in this, I did two cases last year where I had the unusual problem of defending innocent people, which is people...
Almost unheard of.
Unheard of, but yeah. When you're Rake and I share the Rake character and I share this great thing, and that is we love cases that are unwinnable. So when everyone says you can't win them, that's exactly what we want to do. We want to take the unwinnable and pull the rabbit out of the hat. But because psychologically you're on the odds to nothing. You're not really carrying the burden of that person's destiny to a degree because it's unwinnable, but you are. But what's really difficult is when the person you know is completely innocent and yet the prosecutor and the entire brunt of state are against you and you know your client's innocent. That's when it's hard.
I find it impossible to think of you as a prosecutor.
Well, that's what I said. I was hopeless with Harry and I just couldn't do it. It's not in my DNA. But last year I had I defended a trotting driver charged with... Australia's greatest trotting driver, charged with corruption. But you knew he was innocent, and yet there was so much against you. And his whole life and his family's whole life depended on it. and it gives you a burden more than any other because you've got someone with who's innocent. And you get a lot of sexual assault cases now where there's so much more prosecutions. Doesn't mean there's more going on. It just means that the police are under obligations to virtually prosecute every allegation. And that brings with it a lot of burdens.
We did a program last night on the long history of royal commissions into trade unions and indeed the labour movement. They go back until the late 19th century.
I know.
Do you think, it was put to me last night very passionately by an academic from the Catholic University in Canberra, that in fact most royal commissions are efficacious, honourable and not fundamentally politicised?
Yeah, royal commissions are to deflect the attention away from the issue that they are investigating. If you study ICAC investigations, there's virtually no successful prosecutions after the event. That very rarely do you get a successful prosecution after an ICAC investigation. And the same with royal commissions. The royal commissions are entertaining, fabulous, especially if you've got Rupert Murdoch and his son, and I love the whole drama and circus of it. But it's really just going through the motions in a real world. Nothing changes. Except, and I do think the current prosecution in England is a case I'd like to do, where you've got the red-headed Miss Brooks with her old lover Andy Coulson sitting in the dock together. I just think that's great theatre.
Rake ended, this series ended with Cleaver tangled up in a rope being lifted aloft by a great big glowing balloon. Where is the balloon of life going to lift you, take you next?
Well, I think a lot of barristers are said to be full of hot air, and I think that symbol was used to see where we're going to go. If you recall the last series, Cleaver was on his haunches about to be a victim certain prison rituals, but he seems to have turned that around. And now there's no plans for him to come back, but I think he's...
Oh, he's got to come back. We can't live without him.
I can't live without him.
Well, bugger you. There's all of us. We desperately need to... Because what he does is he embodies so much that we admire in this funny mongrel society.
Richard is 99% responsible for that. He's just such a great actor and created such a great character. And Peter Duncan, the other creator of the series, has gathered round him a lot of fabulous talent. And we all love it and love doing it. And some of the cases that we covered in it, the most unbelievable cases, are all true.
It's great to meet you after all these years. I wish we had twice or thrice the time, but good on you, Charles Ward Street. Love your columns. Do you write them or dictate them?
I handwrite them.
You handwrite them?
No, I'm afraid. I think at the rate of handwriting, and I just can't learn to do it. I'm getting dragon, but it's an excuse to have interns in to, translate them.
Yes, okay, no comment. Charles, barrister, filmmaker, actor, inspiration for Rake, and that's our lot for today. On our next, you'll love this, Charles, desire, ambition, love and passion. An entire program-length discussion about Napoleon Bonaparte's wife, Empress Josephine. And there's much about Josephine you don't know, and we'll be delighted to discover. It's time to stick around on RN for the news. And I will see you later.